Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. Matthew Schreier is on his way home from Syria after spending months photographing the war going on there when, just 45 minutes from the safety of the Turkish border, he was taken prisoner by the Al-Nusra Front, a branch of Al-Qaeda in Syria. For the next 7 months, he was starved and tortured in six different prison camps, yet he survived, becoming the first Westerner to escape Al-Qaeda. Today, he talks to the military about what he learned through his experience. Today on the show, I talked to Matt about his book, The Dawn Prayer, which details what he learned about how to survive a Syrian terrorist prison, as well as the lessons he learned and what not to do from a fellow American with whom he was held captive. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/dawnprayer. Matt Schreier, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you just came out with the book, The Dawn Prayer, or How to Survive in a Secret Syrian Terrorist Prison. You were the first Westerner to escape Al-Qaeda from Syria. It's an incredible story. Before we get to how you got captured, to the escape, what were you doing in Syria in 2012? Because you're not a military guy.
No, I'm not. I was there to do freelance photography. I was there about a month before, visiting the refugee camps. I was in southern Turkey. I went into Syria for the first time, to Azaz. And then from there, it was Jordan, where the Zaatari camp was at the time, or still is. It was probably 150,000 people there.
And I mean, what was crazy, I mean, so this is not too long ago, but the Syrian conflict, it's, as I was reading the book, I was reminded how complex the conflict is. For those who aren't familiar with it, like, what was going on in Syria at the time, and is still going on today?
It's always been complex. It's even more complex now because of how many additional players have come to the table. But back then, I got there in late 2012. And at the time, you basically had the Syrian government fighting the Free Syrian Army and other factions like the Al-Nusra Front, who were the guys that captured me, and a lot of other splinter groups. And at the time, the FSA was the main fighting force, the biggest one, and they were kicking ass back then. They were pretty much controlling 85% of Aleppo, which is where I was, and people were defecting left and right. And it looked pretty good for them. It looked like they were going to win any day now. But since the government had an air force, that's what prevented them from actually being able to overwhelm them and actually take over the country. So in the months that followed, that's when you saw like a real rise in the extreme groups with ISIS and mostly Al-Nusra, who had me in 2013.
So, I mean, this what sounds, it's interesting, is like there's like a mixture of like good guys and bad guys who could be good guys who are also bad guys. Is that kind of what it was like? It was just very fluid?
Yeah. I mean, depending on how you define a bad guy, pretty much everyone's a bad guy. If you look at the term, like, everybody tortures everybody over there. That's just a basic common interrogation practice. I mean, there's no group over there that doesn't torture people. So, I mean, if you think torture's bad, then everybody's bad. But then you have to examine what they're fighting for. And that's how you can kind of distinguish how bad they are. Like the Free Syrian Army, where they, you know, they were basically normal guys fighting for freedom. They wanted to you know, be able to smoke cigarettes in public, and which they can do now under the government. But after they won, as opposed to, you know, the Islamists who wanted to, you know, make smoking illegal and alcohol illegal, they just wanted freedom, the Free Syrian Army guys. Their problem was is that they relied too strongly on the extremists to fight a lot of the battles. And before they knew it, the tail was wagging the dog in that aspect.
All right, so you're here in Syria. It's 2012. There's these battles going on. Different groups are there. You were about to leave. You were planning to leave December 31st, 2012. That was your last day in Syria. But then plans changed. What happened there?
I was about 45 minutes from the Turkish border on my way home, and that's when I got rolled up. Basically, the cab was just cruising down the street. And a silver Jeep Cherokee came from the oncoming lane, blocked off the road. I thought we just averted an accident. So for the first second or two, I like smiled and was like, whoa. And then the doors opened and the terrorists got out and my smile disappeared. They were armed to the teeth. Guy in the front seat was cloaked head to toe in black. He had an AK. Guy in the back seat had a chrome 45, I think it was. And they just took me from took me from the cab, put me in the back seat of the Cherokee, very gently, no yelling, no hitting. And a second later, after they pulled my cap over my eyes, we were moving. The whole thing probably took a minute.
I mean, and when that happened, like, what was going through your mind? Like, were you just like panicked, or it happened so fast you couldn't even feel anything?
Pretty much the second. I was just in shock. I was in shock. It's called capture shock. The door just opened and I saw the guy in jet black, you know, just like in a movie, jumps out with his AK, and I just like froze and just watched him come over to me, open the door. And he probably saw the look on my face. He just grabbed me by my arm, very gently took me out of the cab, led me over to the Cherokee, placed me in the back seat, got in after me and closed the door. A second later, he pulled my ski cap, because it gets cold in Syria, over my eyes, and he leaned me forward and just pressed the barrel of the AK to my temple. A second later, we were moving.
And at this point, you still didn't know who captured you.
I mean, I didn't really,
right. You still didn't know who had captured
right.
you.
No, not yet. I mean, I had a feeling who it was, because, you know, this is all before the rise of ISIS. At this time, al-Nusra Front were the number one bad guys in the country, like the guys you didn't want to be taken by. ISIS was, nobody even heard of them at this point. They were not really a heavy presence yet. So I kind of figured it was them, but I wasn't sure. So the whole way to the first jail, I didn't say a word. I just kept my hands up, my mouth shut, and just said to myself, all right, what are you going to do? What are you going to say when you get to wherever you're going? Because obviously, you know, you're going to be questioned. So I just kind of thought about what I was going to say. And, you know, I'd been in the country for 18 days before that. So I knew a lot of high level Free Syrian Army commanders that whose names I could throw around. And, you know, traditionally in Arab culture, a lot of wars before this, if this happened, then you said, all right, look, I was with Sheikh Modar and General Hassoun, and they contacted those guys, they would turn you over to them if they asked. And if they did contact those guys, I knew that they would say, all right, look, give them to me. So I knew I had a chance. So I just tried to stay positive and focus on how to make that happen.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. You said immediately, like, okay, you had the shock of being captured, but then the shock wore off. You immediately came up with a plan to ensure that you stayed alive and two got released. You had the plan, okay, drop these names possibly if it worked, but like staying alive, like you, immediately got to the idea that like, I need to make these people like me if I want to stay alive. And so how did you go about making these guys who you still didn't know who were, they could have been terrorists, Islamic terrorists, or how do you plan to like make these guys like you and cross those cultural barriers?
It was, you know, by the time I started thinking like that, I was at the jail already in the basement. So I just had a couple of minutes. They gave me a hot glass of tea, and over the tea, I was like, all right, you know, what's the main question you want to ask yourself is how do I avoid being tortured? So you have to make them like you. So I said, how do you make somebody like you who, you know, hates you? You make them laugh. I mean, it's just human instinct. I mean, nobody doesn't like the guy who makes them laugh. So I just kind of formulated that strategy and I went with it. And in regards to like knowing what they would laugh at, I didn't know what they would laugh at. You never know. But I spent enough time on the front lines with the FSA guys, who some of them were pretty hardcore religious. And, you know, they loved my sense of humor. So I just kind of, you know, went off of that, you know, experience, and, you know, it worked.
Yeah, that was funny. I mean, some of these guys, even though they were, you know, probably not fans of America. Like they, a lot of them were steeped in American culture. So you could make references to American pop culture from like 20 years ago or 15 years ago, and they would get it.
Sometimes. And when they didn't get it, you know, it's like, all right, you could just kind of laugh at them inside your head because they don't, they don't know what you're talking about and you're kind of mocking them. But in terms of like fashion, like they love American clothes, these guys. That's one of the reasons why, you know, they like me, as funny as that sounds. Cause you know, they took my bag when I was captured and, you know, you'd see guys walking into the cell a couple days later wearing Timberland cargos. And, you know, what I was wearing, the guys would come in the cell and they'd constantly be like, hey, how much was that? How much were those pants? How much was that vest? How much was that hoodie? They love American clothes. So that was something that I was a little surprised at.
And a lot of these guys you described, like they're young, like some of them are like 18, 19, early 20s. Like they're not 30 or 40 years old.
Right. Right. I mean, this is it's not what we're used to seeing in, you know, the videos from Afghanistan where it's like, you know, these old tribal guys. These guys were, you know, mostly veterans from Iraq, you know, so they're in their 20s and 30s, a lot of the fighters. And, you know, kids in their teens who look up to them are joining left and right. So that the group that had me, most of the, you know, like General Muhammad, who was like the main man or became the main man, he was, you know, I think he was like around 32. And the Emir was around the same age as him. So they were really young guys.
And so besides trying to make these guys like you, another thing you picked up really quick is that, and you seem to understand intuitively, is that you had to also assert yourself at the same time as well. You had to show you couldn't be pushed around. Like, how did you know that also would work too, to sort of gain respect?
I wouldn't phrase it like that because, you know, if I carried myself like, you know, like I'm not a man to be pushed around, they would easily show me, you know, how insignificant I was. You know, this is their backyard, their country, their house. I just tried to act like, you know, I wasn't scared. So, you know, to kind of, you know, you're in a very harsh environment with the harshest of people. So if you show them you have balls, you know, they'll respect that. But as far as, you know, taking it further than that, like, you know, I'm not a man to be reckoned with. I didn't take it that far because, you know, you have to, well, earning respect, you have to show respect. So it's a very thin line.
Right. So when they captured you, they started questioning you, like, who are you? Why you're here? And you're like, I'm a photographer. Why didn't they believe you? Why didn't they release me? You showed them the pictures you've been taking. Like, who did they think you were, and why did they think it was important to keep you held hostage?
I actually didn't get a chance to show them the pictures. They uploaded them later after the interrogation. But I mean, they had information that they said they have information that there's CIA operatives in the area, which, you know, they probably did. But, you know, to them, any Westerner is a potential CIA agent. They think anybody who has an iPhone is a CIA agent, you know, which is ridiculous since, you know, most of those guys, they all carry Blackberries, but they don't know this. So it's just because I'm American, I'm a white guy, you know, I have to be a potential CIA agent. They have to grab me and investigate me. And at that time, you know, they were just basically doing that to any Westerner that they came across. They were asking me if I knew where any other journalists were. And I did, because I met several in Southern Turkey, but yeah, I'm not going to tell them. Right. I'm not gonna create a situation where other people are in my situation. So it's just a very simple way of thinking.
So the first few months, they held you in a hospital. What were the conditions like there in this place?
The conditions were, I mean, for me, they weren't that bad because I kind of connected with General Muhammad in our interrogation, and he liked me. So nobody touched me. Nobody, you know, embarrassed me or mistreated me in any way. They fed me all right. They took me to the bathroom. I could knock on the door whenever I wanted something. It was not that bad for me personally. For other people, you know, you'd hear them torturing the hell out of guys right up the hallway for hours on end sometimes, you know, the different screams. Obviously, they're not the same guy for hours, but you'd hear people being shot outside or, I mean, you know, you hear the gunshots, so you, and it's a court that I found out. So, you know, a lot of these are probably sentences being carried out. But for me personally, the first month and 5 days wasn't that bad, as ridiculous as that might sound, because they were being nice to me and respectful.
Who are your fellow prisoners in this hospital?
At first, 5 days in, I started making a lot of noise to convince them that I wasn't a CIA agent. So they shut me up. They put me in a new cell with 18 regime POWs. These are soldiers that fight for the government. And they're mostly Alawi, which is a Shia sect. And the Sunnis hate them. That's what Bashar Assad is. So they threw me in with these guys for 5 days. And they were like the best guys I ever met in my life. They welcomed me and I was shocked. They welcomed me into their little world. We ate together. We exercised, played games when the lights were on. And I mean, it was really refreshing. Unfortunately, 5 days in, they threw about 13 Shabiha. Those are like militants who fight for the regime. And they hate those guys. They consider them traitors to the revolution. So because the cell was so overcrowded, they moved me back to solitary for 13 days. And then after 13 days, that's when they put me in a room with another American who basically had the opposite effect as the Syrian soldiers who were like my boys. This guy turned out to be, a nightmare on top of a nightmare.
Well, which is surprising because you think, an American compatriot, I can relate to this guy. I think that'd be a welcome change. Like, what made this guy a nightmare for you?
I mean, where to begin? Like I described in the book, he was basically the equivalent to journalists of what Gomer Pyle was to Marines in Full Metal Jacket. I mean, the guy, he just couldn't do anything right. He would just constantly piss off the guards without even trying. And on top of that, like the thing that the precipitating incident was, right after I was thrown in the cell, he told me that he was in the country to write a story about Austin Tice, who was the first journalist to go missing, and he's still missing. And when I found out that, that's why he was there, and he said that he was, the whole point of him being there was to make money off this story, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way, because that's like saying, I was in country to do a story about somebody in the same position as you and get paid off of it. So it kind of just like rubbed me the wrong way. And the more time that went by, the more disloyal he seemed to be. Like he told me he would shoot me in the head if they'd let him go, because this is war and that's what you have to do to survive, which is ridiculous. As Americans, we're kind of raised with values. And you stand side by side with the guy next to you in a war zone, even if you don't like him. And meanwhile, the guy who I'm locked in a room with is telling me, no, man, I'd actually shoot you in the head if they let me go. So, these things kind of snowballed very quickly to the point where, I just couldn't stand him.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was just, like, no one liked him. Like, there was absolutely no one. Like, you didn't like him, the prisoners didn't like him, the guards didn't like him. I think we've all met people like that, where they're just, their personality just rubs everyone the wrong way.
Yeah, I think we've all met them, and we can all agree that they're always the person who thinks they're the smartest one in the room. And that was his problem. He thinks because he has a PhD that he's like some kind of genius. But at the same time, he was homeless when he got abducted. He never admitted this to me. He admitted it after he came home in an interview. And it's just like, you're a homeless guy with a PhD. And to me, that's worse than being like a crackhead who's homeless, because at least the crackhead has an excuse. He's a crackhead. What's the guy with a PhD? Like, what's your excuse for being homeless? So he was just like this incredibly pompous guy who, like I said, nobody liked him. The guards would come in the room, the cell, they'd take us to the bathroom. They'd be totally cool, just mellow. And then all of a sudden you hear them screaming and yelling. And I just look at him and I'm like, what are they doing? What'd you do? And he's like, my ass crack was showing. And it's just like, in Islam, that's a sin. And you can't show between your knees and your belly button. And it would drive them nuts. Like they would start getting extremely violent and hostile. And I'm just like, dude, you're 44 years old. I got to tell you to pull your pants up. And it's happened like several times where you're like, Theo, you got to pull your pants up. Come on, buddy. And it was just like constantly, incidents like this or like the part in the book where they throw water down on the floor. They throw a bunch of water down on the floor in our cell, tell us to scrub it and squeegee it out. And he leaves this gigantic puddle in the middle of the floor because he can't even squeegee a room right. And it's like, 40 degrees in the room, so it's not going to dry. And we have to live like this until, basically a week later when they do it again and we have to squeegee it out. And it was just a nightmare, just from beginning to end.
Yeah, that's a big hamper on morale for you. We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Did you know Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? They have everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, houseplants, and so much more. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. So I got a tree from Fast Growing Trees. I had a tree in my front yard that I had to cut down, a big giant oak tree, because it died, and I wanted to put a maple tree there, one that turned bright red during the fall. So I found that tree, made sure that it fit the climate that we're at here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, ordered it. A few days later, I got the tree in a box. It's crazy they can send a tree in a box, and I planted it. A few weeks after I planted it, it's already starting to sprout leaves. So I think in a few years, I'm going to have that bright red maple tree that happens in the fall. I'm really looking forward to that. So if you want to try Fast Growing Trees out, this spring they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off with their first purchase when using code manliness at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code manliness at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, code manliness. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor, and they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now, and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy-to-follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. There's a famous Abraham Lincoln quote that goes something like, "Good things come to those who wait." But that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. Thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you can find qualified candidates fast. And now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/manliness to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And now back to the show. So, I mean, during this time when you guys, the first time you were together, like you all tried to like started hatching an escape plan, right?
Yeah. About 2 weeks in, I decided like I can't be in a room with this guy anymore. He was the motivator of me wanting to escape. It had nothing to do with getting away with Al-Qaeda. I wanted to get away from him. And I was just like, all right, I got to plan something. So one night I'm just staring at the door, and it's just a wood panel door holding us in. You know, they lock it with a key and they leave the key inside. And, you know, a wood panel door obviously has the panel parts where it gets thin. and the wood was really, really thin where the panels were, maybe like, you know, a centimeter. And I'm looking at the thick part of the wood, and there's like this giant silver dollar size impression that somebody carved into the door. So one night I'm just staring at it, and just matter-of-factly, I'm like, yeah, how'd that mark get in the door? And he's like, I put it there. And I'm like, why? And he's like, I was bored. And what'd you use? He's like, I used a spoon. And later on, he admitted that he was trying to make a peephole in the middle of the door, you know, because I guess they, you know, wouldn't know what that is. It's only the size of a silver dollar. And I said, all right, well, if you could do this with a spoon, we can work here. So for the next few days, like, I stole a 3-inch flathead brass screw from the bathroom. And a few days after that, I stole a flat bracket that fit perfectly into the head of the screw. And I put it through the top right corner of the panel in the bottom of the door, which is about the size and width of a milk crate, in and out in less than 5 minutes. You know, barely stripped the screw. And now we had a real peephole that they wouldn't see. You know, you can only see their sneakers, so you could tell who was out there. And my plan was simple. We just perforate all around the sides of this panel and wait for an opportunity to kick it out in one shot, so there's not a lot of noise, and we run for it. He refused to follow that plan. He said, no, I'm not doing that. You know, let's you know, basically perforate all around the doorknob where the wood is like 3 inches thick. You know, it just wasn't possible. And then we'll punch that out and turn the key. Like, ridiculous. Like totally impossible. And he refused to do my plan. So I said, all right, you know, because I was just not thinking clearly, and I knew that it wasn't going to work. So he would have to go back to my plan. But within 2 hours, obviously, you know, the bracket was stripping the screw right away, which is bad because we don't have like a lot of screws to keep going with when my plan comes to fruition again. But unfortunately, General Muhammad heard the bracket strip the screw, and it made a click sound. And then, boom, he busted in with a couple of thugs, started searching the door. And kind of funny because it's like, you know, you expect him to find the mark that I made, but he didn't, because I stayed along the steel plate to hide it that surrounded the doorknob. No, his flashlight falls on this giant impression that my brilliant cellmate put there before I even entered the cell. And he thought that that's what I was doing. So he got a little upset. And the result was he took our beds and tortured the hell out of us and transferred us to a new prison, which was basically the beginning of the darkest stage of my captivity.
And this is when things like they weren't being nice anymore. This is when things got ugly.
No. Yeah. I mean, it changed within, as soon as he saw that mark that my cellmate put in the door, he called me over and he looked at me. And usually General Muhammad was like, he's like this really fascinating character in the book, because you're used to just seeing these dark, evil terrorists with no sense of humor and no personality. He was the opposite. Like, he was a very charismatic, very funny leader that just his men loved. And I actually enjoyed talking to him when he would come in the cell, because he was such a cool guy when he was around me. But as soon as he saw that I was trying to escape, even though it was a completely different mark in the door, like, this darkness came over his eyes. And I saw the other half that Theo told me about, my cellmate, because he hated Theo. He hated him. And he told me about, you know, things that he did to him before I entered the cell, which weren't pleasant. And I saw this look come over his eyes, and I was just like, okay, I'm about to meet that guy. And he was not as pleasant as the one I'd been used to.
What kind of torturing techniques do these guys use on you guys?
On me, basically what they do is they take a tire, a car tire, and they force it around your knees when you're sitting on the floor. So your knees are bent up to your chin, and they force a car tire over it. And then they take a steel rod or an iron rod, and they slide it over the tire, but under your knees in the crook. And what that does is it locks it into place. So now you can't bend your knees. And you're handcuffed, you're handcuffed. So they flip you over and you're on your face with your feet in the air. And then they take this very thick cable, about as thick as a nightstick, and they start whacking the bottoms of your feet with it. And let me tell you something, it hurts. I mean, whenever you see it on TV or the movies, they always use like these thin wooden sticks or paddles almost, and it doesn't really look that painful. But trust me, man, it is hell. And if they really don't like you, what they do is they'll strike the sides of your feet and they'll hit your ankles. They didn't do that to me on this occasion. They did it to my stomach because his ankles were bleeding all over the floor when he got back. But that's what they did on this occasion. There were other prisoners that you would hear stories about that they would hang from pipes by handcuffs. One guy, they bit his ear off. They used high voltage tasers. I took some bolts here and there later on. But in the hospital, that was the main method of torture.
Yeah, well, I think I sent you an email before the interview. Like, I was like, I physically winced. And like, you're just describing right now, I started getting heebie-jeebies thinking about getting your feet hit with that cable. Oh, geez.
Yeah, and the environment where they choose to do it makes it even worse because they bring you into the boiler room. And, you know, there's a reason why Wes Craven chose the boiler room for A Nightmare on Elm Street. It's just like the scariest room in any building. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, and you got bloodstains all over the floor and it's just like one single bulb hanging. So everyone's shadows and you're blindfolded, but you can always see through the bottom of the blindfold. And, you know, and we've all seen the terrorist videos with James Foley, you know, picture 8 of those guys. Because that's what they were all wearing. They all have that costume. So you're basically in a room with a bunch of these guys dressed like that. And this is what's going on. And they have little kids in there watching. They're teaching them, priming them. And it's a very unpleasant experience. And, you know, even when you're not the guy in the tire in the boiler room, you know, there are times where, you know, they take us down to the bathroom and we have to walk right by that room as this is going on. And you just hear them screaming and yelling and it echoes throughout the hallways. And it's just surreal.
So you got moved from the hospital to this place. It's kind of like an electrical facility. And that was the conditions were even worse than the hospital. Like you said, the hospital was actually pretty good. Well, like what changed in this electrical facility? Like why was it so bad?
The Electrical Institute, I think it's like a college / facility type of thing for your regular citizens. But now it was probably one of the biggest terrorist bases in the world. Like if you saw a satellite shot in this place, it's like basically an entire college campus turned into a terrorist base, just to give perspective. And it was, like I described it in the book, it was literally the dark side of hell. I mean, we were in hell before, now we were in the dark side. And what made it the worst was the hunger. Like that was the main form of torture in this place that they inflicted on us, hunger and darkness. A couple of days in, they transferred us to a cell where we spent most of the almost 40 days. And it was dark almost all the time. They barely fed us. And like you could, when you're hungry for, you know, going on for like 30 hours without eating, and then you just get a piece of bread. Or like a little saucer with some halal, and you have to share it with the guy next to you. I mean, it's physically and emotionally draining. And on top of that, there's no light, crawling with bed bugs. So you can't even delouse. So you just feel these bugs crawling all over you, sucking your blood. And people die from that. You know, if you read about prisoner of war experiences, if you don't delouse, you know, these things, they'll suck you dry. So we were in a really bad spot. They would blast music for hours on end, like right outside our door. And then there were the bathroom trips, which were a nightmare unto themselves. You know, we'd have to go to the bathroom like once a day. And it was like walking the gauntlet on the way down there. They didn't really physically torture me that much there. I got flogged with a garden hose once. But mostly it was just they were just torturing my cellmate. Me, they pretty much left alone and just let me suffer with hunger and darkness and bed bugs. But we lived like this for close to 40 days. And after that, they transferred us back to the hospital.
I mean, like during all this time, like what kept you going, especially in this really dark time? Like, was it, did you like fall back on faith? Was it like stoic philosophy, existentialism? Like what was it?
During that time, man, it's really hard to say. You know, there's always this will that you want to get home because you know that your loved ones are suffering. And if you don't get home to them, you know, you're just basically ruining their lives as well as yours. But, you know, my cellmate was a huge inspiration to me because I would look at him and be like, don't be like him. Because the Electrical Institute broke whatever was left of him. And he was just hiding under the covers all day, all night. He never came out unless, you know, it was to eat, go to the bathroom, or pick bed bugs off himself. Because eventually they put light in the room, but I mean, it never worked. Maybe it worked like less than 10% of the time because the electricity was always out. And when you're locked in a room with somebody like that who won't talk, who won't come out from under the covers, you know, this is a 44-year-old man. You know, you can either curl up in a ball and give up like him, or you can keep going. And I just chose to keep going.
So you got moved back to the hospital. You're there for a bit. Then they moved you to a warehouse, right?
Well, the warehouse was a couple of jails. First, from the hospital, you know, they threw the Moroccan guy in with us. And then from there, we were moved to a villa out in the country, which was like a two and a half hour drive. Really, really intense experience. I mean, there was a gunfight at one of the checkpoints. You know, the guys, our transport lost two guys during that. Really intense. Like the suicide bombers were out, standing like 20 feet away from us, ready to go. And we got to a villa, General Muhammad's villa. It had a prison in the basement, like all Syrian villas. And then we were transferred back into Aleppo, into the hands of another terrorist group for about a month and a half. And I was back with the soldiers at that point. And then after that, that's when we were transferred to the warehouse.
Gotcha. Hey, and you mentioned the Moroccan. He kind of joined you and became a part of you and Theo's little group there. This guy sounded crazy because he knew, right. Tell us about this guy.
The Moroccan was, I mean, he was, I mean, as much as I hated Theo, I hated the Moroccan. And this guy was extremely intelligent and a psychopath at the same time. And basically his story was almost too hard to believe, like a lot of my story. But long story short is he went to Syria from Morocco after stealing his sister's car and selling it so he can finance the trip because he got into a big fight with his dad. And when he got there, he started pretending that he was a doctor to the point where he was working with Doctors Without Borders. Like he literally knew people who were in that organization that I found out, like I confirmed a lot of it after I came home and joined Al-Nusra, the Al-Nusra Front, the terrorist group, as a doctor. And needless to say, he had no degree or no education at being a doctor. So it didn't really take him that long to figure out his game. And after marrying a woman under this false identity, which is a big deal in that part of the world, like a half hour after the wedding, they shot him. He was driving in a car. They got pulled over the same fashion I did. They shot him in the leg, threw him in the trunk, and brought him to the hospital, where they basically locked him in the torture room, cuffed him to a bed, and left him there for like a week without any medical attention, just shoved the catheter in him and let it empty out into a bucket. Unbelievable that this guy survived. By the time they threw him in with us, you know, his leg was just, the bullet hole was healed over, but it was so bloated. Like it looked like it was going to pop. And his feet, you know, and you could feel his femur was just broken. And he was basically, like I said, he was like 6'3", 230 pounds. And I got along with him at first because he spoke English and lived in the States for 12 years. He got deported for, you know, falsifying his personal information on a Banana Republic job application, if you can believe that. And it's just, you can't make this up. And he was very dominant. And that's when I started fighting with him because, you know, he was trying to be like the head guy in the cell. And, you know, I'm not going to be bossed around by anybody if you don't have a gun, and especially somebody with a broken leg. But Theo, my cellmate, became his property. It was basically, once I started fighting with the Moroccan, Theo was his property. So it was like two against one. And that all changed when we were transferred into a cell with the soldiers again, who I became friends with early on. So now I had like over 20 guys with me, and they were just basically on their own because the soldiers hated Theo because he's Theo, and they hated the Moroccan because he's their enemy. He's, you know, an admitted member of a terrorist organization, and, you know, the American who's basically his sidekick is not going to really hold favor with them. Not just because he's working with their enemy, but because he's betraying his country. You know, they don't hate America, the soldiers, at least at that point, but they didn't love America either because of our government. And, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from or who you are, when you see somebody, you know, who's not standing up for where he's from and basically betraying it, you can't respect them. So that's basically why the soldiers straight off the bat didn't like him.
So things just got worse with Theo as you guys got moved along, and you got moved with the Moroccan too, and you reached a point where the Moroccan got taken away one night and he didn't come back, right?
Right. The Moroccan, like I said, he was a big dude. So the prison that I broke out of, the windows, you know, like any basement windows, they're high up off the ground and, you know, they're very narrow. And one night they just came down, a whole bunch of guys, and we never got visitors that late. So it was like a really odd occurrence, and we could feel it that something was going to happen. It's weird how you get this intuition when something's about to happen over there. And we heard them lining up outside the door, and we had to face the wall every time they came in. We weren't allowed to look at them. And the Moroccan said, he's like, there's a lot of people out there. And you could tell he was scared. And I was just like, yeah. And they came in, they asked him his name, said his name, and then they took him. And he never came back. And this is after like 4 months of being stuck in a room with this guy for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with no end in sight. So it was refreshing to have him gone. We found out they killed him later on. And because he was gone, now that's when we started planning the escape, because there was no way he could fit through the window. So once he was gone, it created the opportunity.
Right. And initially, Theo was on board, but then he had like this like change of heart. He said, like, I'm actually going to turn you in if you try to escape.
Yeah. Well, I mean, escapes usually don't work out the first time, you know? And it didn't work out the first time when we ended up at the Electrical Institute. It didn't work out the first time on this occasion. So I figured out why it didn't work, and I amended the plan. And by then he was like, no, I changed my mind. I'm not doing it. If you try to do it, I'm going to knock on the door and tell on you. And I was just like, you're going to tell on me. You're going to turn me into Al-Qaeda. And he's like, yeah. So I didn't think he was being serious. I thought he was just, you know, being himself. And when I went over to the window, he knocked on the door and loud, like he was literally going to rat me out. He admits that he did all this, by the way. This isn't like something my word against his. He admits that he did this. And he turned around with his chest out, like, you know, like, I'm a tough guy. Al-Qaeda's got my back. So the only way to get him back on board was to make him so miserable that he wouldn't want to be stuck in a room with me anymore. So that's what I did. It took about 3 hours.
What'd you do?
I just insulted him and broke on him for just nonstop for like 3 hours. Just about, you know, what a disgrace he was to our country. Like how, you know, how it's bad enough the terrorists are holding me here. Now you're the one holding me here. How, you know, you're going to let, you know, his mother was like 79, 80 years old. I was like, you're going to let your mother die not knowing what happened to you, or worse, having to watch you get your head cut off online, you know, just stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of language that I don't want to use here, applying that to him until he basically was just like, okay. He's like, I can't take it anymore. type of thing. He's like, I didn't say I was completely turned off to it. And that's when we started, you know, planning it again. And, you know, obviously he's like, well, we have to wait 3 days, because he was, you know, he was doing everything he could to try to thwart the attempt. And, you know, 3 days we were due to be transferred. So he was hoping we'd be transferred or they'd throw somebody else in with us, which they did twice in that cell after the Moroccan was gone, but they always took him away. So if those things happened, we would have had to scrap the idea. But, you know, fortunately for me, it didn't happen. So he had to go forward with it.
So we'll let people check out the book so they can get the escape parts. It's interesting what happens.
Right.
Particularly with Theo. Well, Matt, is there some place people can go to learn more about your work and the book?
I have a website, MatthewSchreier.com. The book is on Amazon, The Dawn Prayer, or How to Survive in a Secret Syrian Terrorist Prison. That's the best way to learn about me and my experience. And it's a completely different book than any that have come out before, you know, because I'm not trying to get your pity. I don't deserve it. Nobody told me to go over there. And it's actually pretty funny because I'm not trying to make you cry a river. So if anybody really wants to learn about this, that's probably the best way. Just read the book.
Fantastic. Well, Matthew Schreier, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Brett, thank you for having me, man. Ever have another book? I'd love to come back.
My guest today is Matthew Schreier. He is the author of the book, The Dawn Prayer. It's available on Amazon.com. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/dawnprayer, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the A1 podcast. Check out our website, artofmanliness.com, where you can find all of our podcast archives there. Got over 480 episodes, as well as the thousands of articles written over the years about personal finance, health and fitness, relationships, you name it, we've got it. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay reminding you not only listen to the A1 podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.